Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi from Cornell University and a former columnist, blogger, and now radio host for TurfNet, an online community of turfgrass professionals found on the web at turfnet.com. Thanks in advance for joining us and for putting us on your playlist. I recently had a chance to speak frankly with Michael Stakowitz, the turfgrass specialist for the National Park Service and specifically responsible these days for the National Mall and Monuments. Michael is a former golf course superintendent, now responsible for managing our nation's front lawn. Today, our guest, Michael Stakowitz, the turf specialist for the National Park Service at the National Mall and Memorial Parks. What a joy to have a professional like Michael on. And like all my shows, one of the great parts of doing this work is I'm more geeked about these things than ever these days, because you can really study up when you get to talk to people about their livelihoods. One of my favorite things to do on Frankly Speaking is really to talk to people in the turf industry about the things they their day-to-day jobs, because I think sometimes I've always contended we sort of work in anonymity to a lot of people, and it's not always obvious the work that we do and the way we go about what we do, and the grind that you either get used to, adapt to in some way, or find ways to modify it to make it work. And Michael's work at the National Mall with the National Park Service is a great example of that. So we're going to wander through a conversation about our nation's capital, the National Mall, a memorial parks that Michael's responsible for. So let me introduce to you Michael Stakowitz, the turf specialist. Michael, thank you for joining me on Frankly Speaking. It's great to have you here.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm a longtime listener and really honored to be here.
Great. This is so wonderful that now we're starting to get opportunities to have people who regularly listen be part of it. And that's, you know, to be honest, one of the things about TurfNet that I've always liked is that there is a community of people. So, Michael, let's get right at this. So you're a Western Massachusetts native, as I have seen in studying up on you on this, and a UMass grad. So that means was Joe Troll long gone? And so you're a Ebden DaCosta Vidim Prostack creation out of the University of Massachusetts?
I was kind of in between those eras. Dr. Troll had just retired when I started, so Rich Cooper was actually there at that time when I was there. So I was kind of in between. Marcus Camby years, but also Rich Cooper years too.
Oh, very good. Because I've known Rich Cooper a really long time, and I knew him when he worked at UMass. It was always great to see Rich smoking a cigar at field day. He was always really good for that. So obviously you came up through the golf course end of it, right? So you worked your way through several golf courses and then was the superintendent at Dedham Golf and Polo Club.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. And so it looks like you were there 9 years or so. So was that, as we might imagine, a typical private Northeast golf course, private club, successful membership? I see you, achieved Audubon certification, which is an achievement in and of itself. You know, you had done some conversions there. So you had been a fairly active guy in 9 years. Is that it says here, greens and grounds manager. I'm assuming that means golf course superintendent as well.
Yeah, it does. Dedham was actually, I didn't even think like a place like that existed. It was, it's a typical, outside Boston country club of sorts. But what it was when it got there was they hadn't realized that it was, or just started to realize when I was interviewing, was that it was Seth Rayner designed, or at least, at that point, half Seth Rayner and half Donald Ross. So I think that's part of how I ended up with the job, was like I just got super enthused by it. So the idea to be able to go in and start with that enthusiasm and just start kind of going at it and capturing people's imaginations and trying to move the ball forward when it came to that, we brought in Brian Silva to help us draw it up, and piece by piece we did some projects. We never ended up doing like a whole scale thing, but there's a lot of things that we were able to do to kind of bring back what we had been missing, with the tree removal program and widening fairways and redoing some bunkers and doing some green expansions And,
so it sounds like, really exciting. It sounds like a really, good job and the kind of thing that would keep you excited. And the fact that you sort of were involved in sort of moving it like this, like it was a diamond in the rough, almost the way it's been able to sort of be, restored. And so then it only begs the question, Michael, obviously you had plenty of time left there at only 9 years there. And with all that work, I mean, one of two things happen, right? You get tired of the sort of constant pace of having to sort of redo things all the time. Or you get bored. You feel like, okay, I've gone as far as I can here. What then, was it one of those two things that led to the change where you are?
No, in all honesty, I actually ended up losing my job at the end of the ninth year. I was really very aggressive when it came to a lot of things. When it came to the tree removal, when it came to, fairway top dressing, which is also really pretty controversial.
Sounds like you tried to ramp it up.
Oh no, I definitely ramped it up, but I was not necessarily good enough at the politics, or didn't see or knew how to play it very well. So it ended up where. I think the writing was kind of starting to get on the wall when the new president had started a second green committee. So it was really kind of a brutal political situation where you're working with one green committee, the green committee that you've been working with for 8 or 9 years, and then there's another green committee that gets called the Golf Course Conditioning Committee. That gets started up, and so you're trying to serve two masters, and it definitely was to a point where there was definitely some politics.
It's very funny to hear you. I mean, funny for me now, right? Not so funny for you. It's very funny how I can laugh about this, but you sound like you've grown from it, which is the upside. And I gotta say, Michael, to hear you describe it, and now to think about the role you're in that puts such a premium on that, skill at the time you felt like maybe you could have been better at. Isn't that ironic, the way your career has sort of evolved from that change at Dedham to where you are now?
That might be overstating it. I don't, but it's we can basically touch on the fact that, like, hey, I definitely grew from that. And you grow from, like, any time you go outside your comfort zone, anytime you have to switch jobs, anytime you have to move, you definitely grow from that. And that's awesome. I mean, I look back at that really, really, fondly. I was like, thank God. And then I had spent a couple of years trying to look for a way to get into parks because their mission and their civic engagement was like a lot more interesting to me at that point. And so I did see the political writing on the wall at Dedham, and was like really trying to do something different. And like at Dedham, I had reached like all my goals. I was like, I was able to start a renovation. I was able to do a master plan. I was able to, convert the fairways to bent grass and, really kind of turn around a course that had, that's in the Charles River floodplain and was unplayable, every time it rained.
You put in what, 3 miles or more of drainage. So, these are the kinds of things that happen in clubs, don't you think, Michael, all the time where there's a lot of disruption. It almost feels like you're always digging something up or you're always doing something else. And if one guy seems to get their ball in the wrong spot on a regular basis, that oftentimes those are hard trains to sort of stop getting going if there's agendas. So it is fascinating to me that you have embraced the whole idea of civic engagement from the national park thing. And I tell you, your interviews with the Washington Post and NPR and other groups that I've seen television stations has really been, I think, a testament to you raising the whole profession, you know, as a profession. Some of these articles go into quite a bit of detail about, you know, your responsibility. So it's a real teachable moment, I think, and I'm really pleased to hear you say that was a motivating force for you to move to the National Park Service.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I think all of us, if you actually kind of think about it, you know, you think about, you know, people that you know and the kind of pride that they take. I mean, in each golf course, you know, in each sports field, I mean, there's a community in, you know, that uses those things. And those are kind of your happiest times when, you know, you're being able to provide for an entire community for a tournament or that sort of thing. It's not just getting ready in the, you know, for the tournament. It's the fact that it's just like a wide community that uses it. Or if you get some sort of notoriety or coverage, you know, from an important, you know, a statewide tournament or that sort of thing. Those are things that are all awesome when everybody can have kind of like a touchstone. I just think about, you know, the Mullins, like, you know, just about everybody's made it here, you know, by the eighth grade because
right.
of all the field
trips.
Right.
Like, just about so everybody's made it there by the eighth grade.
So everybody's like got like kind of this feeling about it, this sense of ownership about it, the sense of connection. And that is, you know, that is really cool to be involved with something, you know, something like that. And know and realize that you are part of something that is important to not just 400 people, but a lot more people. And those are all, you know, those are all really valid feelings. So this is like kind of like a huge manifestation of that.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, Michael, we're going to go to a message from our sponsors because that's a really perfect way for you to, I think, sum it up in words, how your career sort of naturally got you to this point. And when we come back, we'll talk with Michael Stackowitz, the turf specialist for the National Park Service, more about what is, in fact, the National Mall and Memorial Parks. When we come back on Frankly Speaking, I'm Frank Rossi. Superintendents all agree that traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water filtration, improves gas exchange, and mends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the surface smooth and playable. And I can testify, I've been involved with a number of projects where Dryject was used, and that is in fact true, that it's not very noticeable by the golfers. Best of all, the independent Dryject service professional does it for you. There and gone before you know it. Dryject, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. You can visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center and tell them that you're a listener to Frankly Speaking.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Frank Rossi here on the TurfNet Radio Network with Michael Stackowitz, the turf specialist for the National Park Service at the National Mall Memorial Parks. And when we left off, Michael did such a wonderful job of really sort of tying it all, the career evolution that he's experienced and how he's able to sort of, you know, really grow into this position that he is at, where he so aptly said everybody visits by the eighth grade. So, Michael, let's define this for everybody where we all go, because there's this wonderful article from I can't actually tell when it was from, but the Washington Post did a really nice thing on the evolution of the National Mall from what it was originally, which looked like a wet area, like a river or something came in. And then over time, they sort of manipulated the land, and this Pierre L'Enfant, this French guy, came in and designed it for Washington. And then there's been a bunch of here, there, and other things. And I think by all measure, when people go there, they have an idea of what the mall is, right? That's the grass area. But why don't you just take a minute and tell us what is the landscape that you're managing?
Yeah, so that's funny you bring that up, because, you know, we all kind of have this idea of like what the view from the Capitol is to the Washington Monument, and that being the mall. And, and we all kind of think of it as being very static. But, you know, it actually over, you know, it's been there for 100, the way that it is since the McMillan Commission, you know, it's been there for, you know, close to a century or a little bit more. But you just kind of think of these things as being, you know, having been there, you know, static forever. So, you know, like we talked about, you know, that area between the Capitol, which is not part of the Park Service, that's part of the architect of the Capitol, to the Washington Monument, and then past, you know, is the mall proper that we, you know, usually call. The National Mall would be, include like the reflecting pool, keep going west towards the reflecting pool, Lincoln, all the memorials down to Jefferson Memorial. And, you know, and that is, that area is all manufactured, all fill. So from what was basically, you know, a swamp at the time.
Yeah, it was, if so, by the original drawings, it was a swamp, and it's been filled all these years, and now are, and now there's, they had to build, I read they built some sort of retaining wall or filled it even more just to line up the Jefferson Memorial with the White House.
Oh yeah, that, you know, that that view, that that sight line, you know, was really, really important. And it was, and it's actually kind of funny because it ended up being kind of accidental. But once they kind of latched onto that, it certainly is one of the neater things. That's for sure.
So as far as so let's define. Look, let's take a couple of caveats first. So you said something about the Capitol. That Capitol is managed by another group.
Yeah, it's called the architect of the Capitol. The grounds of the Capitol are managed by, and facilities are managed by a group called the Architect of the Capitol. And that's, that's buildings and facilities and grounds that is funded directly by Congress. I don't have anything really to do with them, other than
they're not part of the National Park Service.
Not part of the National Park Service. So
isn't that odd?
You know what? The funny thing about D.C. is like all these jurisdictions, like, where you have federal agencies that have their own rules and their own police departments. So we have Park Police here. Treasury has their own police department, and you have D.C. police departments. So you mean you have all these different jurisdictions. You actually have along the mall, you have the Smithsonian's and the Smithsonian grounds. And they have their own grounds crew and their own facilities.
Okay, so even the buildings adjacent to that area are not under your purview.
No, not underneath the park. You know, and both the architect of the Capitol and the Smithsonian have both done a really good job of professionalizing grounds care. They
Excellent.
Do a fantastic job there.
Excellent.
There's several levels of employees, you know, government employees, and they've got, you know, there's a kind of a professional GS scale is what they call it, and then there's a wage grade scale, which is a WG
scale.
We they've done a really good job of becoming more and more professional and getting some GS people in there.
Yeah, and I mean, that's obviously, so it sounds like you guys at least have some cooperation with the Smithsonian people. Are you at least aware of each other?
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, I mean, somebody like you with a wealth of turf knowledge, you're certainly, as you said, one of your articles, one of the only, if the only turf person in the whole National Park Service. You know, that's a pretty big responsibility. Has that allowed you to sort of reach out to the Smithsonian and Architect of the Capitol people, or they got their own turf expertise over there?
The Smithsonian does a really good job. The dirty secret is that if your grass is behind a fence, it's not that hard to grow.
That's exactly
so,
right.
But
the guys in Central Park, they'll tell you the same
thing.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, I do know some of the people over at Smithsonian, and we do coordinate on some things. And then the architect of the Capitol, they're starting to be, after they've seen what we've done as far as our renovation of the mall, it's something that they have interest in looking at for their West Lawn that connects with the mall. So we're starting to have some preliminary talks, they're nosing around, finding out what we've done here. So,
all right. So obviously lots of hubbub over the bunch of last several years in the renovation of just that green space between the monument and the Capitol that we call
the mall, yep.
Right? That to a version of a sand-based system.
Yep.
And I believe with a tall fescue bluegrass sod over the top.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Great. Okay, so what about, before we get to the details of that, right, because there's a number of aspects there, Not the least of which I'm finding out now is it's all on Phil. it's all on Phil. What about the landscapes around the memorials? What goes on there? To be honest, I haven't been down there since my son was in the eighth grade. It's funny that you said that. So I can't recall what exactly the grounds are like around the memorials, but is that a complicated irrigated landscape as well?
So those each have their own interesting challenges. When I got here five years ago now, they were not aware of having irrigation systems in those areas, and they weren't working. So we did manage to go and find them and actually start to kind of find a way to get them working. And ramp them up. So only, you know, around each one of the memorials, there are irrigation systems of various quality that have, you know, last year was the first year they were all operational. We ended up with a company that came in and did part of the whole region of all the parks in D.C. That are national parks, where they came into with a deal. You know, it's 20 years of managing the irrigation systems, and they get to realize the water savings. So that's a thing now. So we had some challenges at first. These soils that are here that aren't on the mall, but I still manage the mall. They didn't do anything to the mall. But the soils here are fill soils. I mean, they are tight, greasy. A lot of clay, a lot of silt, so it is really difficult to water, and then they're finding that, and this is, you know, any superintendent will tell you that a good majority of their job is how water is applied and how water is taken away.
Well, right, and is in fact, furthermore, as we have talked, and you know from listening, we are absolutely obsessed on, frankly speaking, with draining profiles, sand-based systems, organic matter management, all the things we talk about that govern the performance of any surface. Michael, you are exactly correct. Is managing those soil physical properties, and when you describe these things as fill soils, I got to think systematically they're going to have to go in eventually and redo all these things with an engineered material if they wanted to perform in any way, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there is some opportunity around the memorials where there aren't many events, there's not much activity directly on them. They're more of ornamental.
So they're just ornamental lawns.
They're most ornamental. So there's an opportunity there to start making a dent as much as we can. The other ones, like the Washington Monument, you wouldn't believe it, but there's about 100 acres sitting right there in the middle.
That
is really heavily used, and that would probably be the next thing to try to redo.
So, before I let you go any further, that number was a big wow. How much turf do you actually oversee?
That's a really hard question. I don't think I've ever added it up. I have spreadsheets on tabs after spreadsheet tabs, but I don't think.
So we got 100 acres for the Washington Memorial. How big is the mall?
So the mall is about 48 acres total, going down there, and then there's 600 acres of park here in the heart of DC in the Memorial Parks.
Right. Okay. 600 acres. Right. Yeah. But I mean, I could see easily you're at 200 maybe that you're managing.
Yeah. A good portion of it. That doesn't all get managed. As you and I kind of talked about before going on, it's like I have kind of a weird position where I'm an agronomist. So for the park, so I have contracts to do all the things that would care for the turf and get it to grow, the aerating, the seeding, the fertilizing, the application,
right.
All that in the seeding, all that stuff. And then the crew that's underneath somebody else, does the mowing.
Right. But my point is, you say you don't manage it, but yes, you don't maybe physically do the work, but it's under your, it's getting mowed, at least getting mowed. It may get a fertilizer, or I don't know, what is the policy for the for fertilizer and chemical use on these grounds?
We try to be the idea is to be as sustainable as possible. But you also have this with this idea of like a cultural resource. Okay, so the Park Service is about resource management and resource preservation, but as a cultural resource, we have a stand going down either side of the mall that's all American elms. And what American elms get is Dutch elm disease, which is not a sustainable model at all, but it's a cultural landscape that has been there for 100 years. So, that gets maintained. We have grass that has to be, around memorials that has to be maintained in a respectful manner of that monument or memorials. So, you do what you have to do in order to get that. And, everybody gets really kind of up in arms about a pesticide application of sort, but these don't require, that much. We're talking about trying to control crabgrass and goosegrass and maybe some knotweed. I mean, that's really what you're looking at trying to do.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think it is important for everybody to understand. You probably have, when you're managing, as your role, right, in sort of providing the plan and managing the operation, of course, you're zoning out the way you're doing things, right? It's not, as many people think about with golf course, they spray everything everywhere all the time. You would say the same rules apply for you. You're targeting intensity of your management, right?
Right.
You said it to me earlier when I was saying, well, they're probably going to want to redo those soils. And you said, well, they grow good ornamental grass. And if all I got to do is kill the weeds a little bit, that's not a challenging thing. And I do like to see you talk about things like, the respectfulness of cultural landscapes. And listen, American elm, all of these monocultural tree alleys, right?
Mm-hmm.
These alleys,
yeah,
of monoculture. I have a colleague here, Professor Nina Basic at Cornell, that calls that tree porn because you shouldn't really, you can't stop looking at it, but you shouldn't really do it, right? It's that sort of thing because of what you describe. And so obviously the measures you have to take just to preserve those trees, I think are really important. And I think, and I'm sure you know better than I do, how much that's probably not considered by too many people who walk by those trees every day, measures you take to preserve them.
Right, right. And the funny thing is that you would be amazed at how many people would say, why wouldn't you just plant something else? The same people who said to me about the mall, why wouldn't you just, when there's this conflict between trying to grow grass and all the events that want to happen on the mall, why wouldn't you just pave over the mall? It's like, and you start thinking this is a cultural landscape, and people just don't get the fact that these landscapes are important for this generation, past generations, and future generations, and you're trying to preserve them.
And I tell you once again, Michael, you're a natural at this. You brought me to a beautiful segue that we can come back after the message from our sponsors and talk about event management, right? The challenges you face with having to manage that heavily used of an operation. And make sure you're preserving it as well. So I can tell by some of the language you started to use already that our conversation when we come back with Michael Stakowicz will be very interesting with how he balances that fine line between public access and rights as citizenry with making sure that the turf is preserved for everyone. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. We're having a conversation about our nation's capital today with Michael Stakowicz, the turf specialist for the National Park Service. We'll be right back.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Frank Rossi here from Cornell University. On Frankly Speaking, part of the TurfNet Radio Network, today with Michael Stakowicz, the turf specialist for the National Park Service at the National Mall Memorial Parks, which we have wandered through Michael's career a little bit and some of his thoughtful approach to his work. We have wandered a little bit to what defines this landscape that he's managing and just touched very, very briefly on some of the challenges that would be unique when you're dealing with a cultural landscape as Michael is faced with there. And so then Michael leads us to the wonderful segue you provided, the challenges you face with balancing, allowing use and preserving it for everyone else, right? And that, to me, is exactly the same mindset that, you know, a sports turf manager at a school district's trying to make on their fields. You know, when a tournament comes in for the weekend, people come from out of town, the fields are going to be destroyed for the next several weeks for the kids that are there. So, you know, that sort of balancing is a unique version of it that you have in D.C. So, first of all, I got to believe it starts out with a calendar of events, right? People say, here's when we're going to let you use this space. And then the battles ensue, right?
So probably the best part about my job is being able to be seen as a technical expert and not be second-guessed by a green committee or coaches. So that allows us to do a lot more, allows us to have a lot more flexibility to be successful when it comes to when events are and how and where they are held and the resource protection that goes into that they have to provide when they have events. So we do, you know, as far as the calendar goes, there is a calendar, but there are so many events that happen on the mall. You know, there are 3,000 events, and not all of them are big giant events. Some of those are weddings, but there's a lot of activity around events and how they use
3,000 events.
Yeah, and throughout the park, throughout all the space, the 600 acres that we have. So I don't want to overstate, you know, what is happening on the turf on the mall, because that's not it still gets a lot of use, but it's not that level.
Right. Okay. So I jumped ahead a little bit. Let's go back to the. I want to focus right on the mall, right? Because that's what was, right. I would assume it consumed a fair amount of your time for a number of years, and just, you know, I do work in New York City. I've done it at Yankee Stadium, Central Park, all kinds of High Line, you name it. In urban environments, it's tough to build stuff, period.
Yeah.
Because trucks have to move in and out of there. So I don't want to go through the gory details, but was there anything unique about the sand-based construction that the mall received?
You know, I don't, not, the only thing, the only consideration that we, that Norm Hummel worked on this, the only real consideration is the idea of like a little bit more silt and clay in it,
for stability. You
know, just to build it and then like to try to like kind of hold it together. I mean, anybody who's lost some turf on some USGA greens or even regular greens that have been top dressed for years, you get these sand blowouts that it's just impossible to try to reestablish grass on. It makes it really difficult. So, being the fact that a blowout could happen on, where some base paths are or where home plate is
on
the mall.
Right.
You know, we wanted, if we lost grass and it takes us a while to get through contracting to get, grass put back in there, that, that it would stay together. We wouldn't ruin the integrity of it.
So right.
That's really the only like real special thing that we've done with that construction.
There's drainage. I'm assuming there's internal drainage.
Yeah, I mean, and that's down 4 feet. So it's kind of out of the way of stakes, but we're not going to just in case it happens. You know that we don't allow stakes on those panels.
But just in case,
to keep it down. I mean, you're building something that's supposed to be there for generations. You know, so
that's right. That's exactly right. So you're not telling me you got 4 feet of root zone mix, right?
No. It's a regular 12 inches of root zone mix on top of a 4-inch stone layer. Okay. It's just that the drainage, trenches down are 4 feet. The irrigation's down 4 feet.
Okay. Very good. So you've got this sand-based system in there. I mean, that again could be a whole conversation in and of itself. And it's got a nice tall fescue, bluegrass sod. I'm assuming you put it in big roll on the surface, correct?
Yep. Great. Yep.
And so when did it go in?
We sodded. So there's been a couple of phases, but the most recent one was we finished up last year in 2016, and it went in through various phases through May through August. Sod was installed. So
over the season of 2015, the whole mall was re-sodded, or was it sodded in stages?
It was sodded in stages as we finished what we call a panel. Each one of those rectangles that leads to that goes down the center.
Yes,
is a panel that what we call a panel, and that, you know, that each one of those was completed, we would have had them sod.
Okay, so that particular space is how many acres?
Just the center panels is 18 acres.
18 acres in the center panels, and they're irrigated.
They are irrigated.
Okay. So now you got this grass that's been in there August of 16, brand new grass. And lo and behold, the United States decides to hold an election, and we have an inauguration. And so was this the first real test of the flooring system that you had to install, both? You know, I would imagine flooring the 18 acres, I mean, just the logistics of labor of moving those little panels is to me a logistical nightmare. Was that the first big event you had there?
No, so for the sake of simplicity, I kind of like left out some things. But when I first started in 2012, like in December 2012, there had been already three panels, about 6 acres, had been completed nearer to the Capitol. So those for Obama's second inauguration, we had covered those. And, you know, so that was only about between 6 and 7 acres we ended up covering there. And it was kind of the first foray into this, idea of covering. And we had some really tender grass seed in one of the areas, because it wasn't one of the areas that was rebuilt, but it was because of construction it had to be seeded, and we didn't really cover it to protect that, but mostly to stop people from, you know, getting muddy if it was wet or whatever. And those panels, you know, protected it. It came off like they hadn't done anything. So as long as you can put, you know, these panels down, you know, and keep people from driving on them, you know, that.
So that well, was, they got different that, panels for that, right? If guys want to drive on them, they got heavier duty ones for that.
They do have heavier duty ones, but even those, when we start allowing those in other areas of the park, if you get any sort of rain at all during load-in, there's just so much traffic and so much weight going back and forth that eventually you end up doing damage to the turf. So, you know, basically, with the amount of events that we have, if we want to keep grass, if we can't accept damage, which is the premise. I mean, that we aren't allowed to, accept damage. I mean, sometimes it happens and you have to repair it, but in general, if you accept damage, then that means that you're in a perpetual state of event then damage repair, event then damage repair, as opposed to if you do damage prevention, where you are taking all the proper, you know, proper things to make sure you don't end up with resource damage, which includes not allowing, you know, vehicles to drive on turf when it's even covered turf when it's wet. It includes putting decking down. It includes the amount of time decking can be down.
That was my question. Before you go further, how long can the decking stay on before? And of course, it's got to be a little bit time of year as well. But how long have you been? What you're describing, Michael, and I interrupted you, I'm sure, when you were about to say you set up all these standards for the kinds of things that you put in place that you call damage prevention. So that the resource, the lawn, the mall, isn't damaged. So that just the use of that language to me is really fascinating, because that's how we have to have people think about this. If I think one of the problems we have in this business, sometimes people think, oh, well, what the hell? He's just mowing the grass. What the hell? It's just grass. I take care of my lawn. How hard could that be? And when you start to talk about resource management and damage prevention, it, I think, puts it in a different context. Do you have a SOP or standard operating procedures for the kinds of things you do, both in preventing damage by protecting the turf, but also restricting what are sometimes difficult to do? Those contractors, they're not so easy to control, I've learned from working at golf events and Yankee Stadium. They're not always as respectful as you like them to be.
No, they aren't. So, I mean, there's a lot there to unpack, Frank. So,
yeah.
So
well, take your time.
Let me go and
take
do this.
Your time.
To finish the last thought, damage prevention rather than damage repair. It's like that allows an event to come in and then leave. And then someone else can use it afterwards. You've prevented the damage from happening, and now it's available to people who want to, you know, play sports on it that evening or have a picnic because they're in town and with their family, and that's what you do in a park. So all those things, it's like the turf area is so many things to so many different people that you do have to make sure that you're managing this and protecting the resource, you know, so that people can use it when they come in and it is what they expect. So, you know, so that's the kind of the tie into that first thought. It's your second question about talking about, you know, the amount of time things can be covered it does vary seasonally. In the wintertime, we had it down for 10 days. Having the decking down in the wintertime doesn't scare me. You know, we cover greens all the time. We cover sports fields.
Of course. When it's dormant, I think you want to be careful because is air restricted underneath there? I mean, air obviously can get out, but you don't feel like it's like ice encasement when you put these floorings on these turf areas.
No, there's some like the solid back ones that you would use for vehicle access. Those don't have holes in them, but these hollow back ones, these ones with a kind of a grid in the back of it that will sit up above the turf crown by, you know, an inch and a half, 2 inches. Those, you know, not only let a lot more light through, they also have each little grid cell has holes for gas exchange.
So, right. Okay. Good.
So that doesn't bother me. But the thing is that those panels, it's important that they be translucent and let some light through, but they also raise the temperature about 10 degrees. So, you know, that's in most cases not bad in the wintertime, just moderates things, which you would expect from a cover. During the summertime, though, when you have, you know, mid-90s in a normal day in July, that extra 10 degrees on the turf is pretty brutal. So we do limit it down to 3 days. And then you start then there's now the nuance of not just covering it, but making sure that there's restrictions on how you set up on top of it to allow for photosynthesis to occur. Because if you put that down and put a carpet on top of it, you've negated the benefit of covering.
So these things are, these floorings are not opaque in the sense that they do let light through.
Right. They look white on TV or when you're walking over them, but they do let light. You can hold a flashlight up. And then, you know, I guess research says it allows about 25% of the ambient light through, which is enough. I mean, it's not ideal, obviously, but it's enough to help out.
Right. And then I know the kid at Virginia Tech was playing around with putting these LED lights in those panels. We played around with them at Yankee Stadium a number of years ago, I think when he started his graduate program. That's a fascinating little innovation, but I'm more interested in the intersection now, Michael, of knowing that it was going to be covered, knowing that the temperatures and things were going to be a little bit more hostile. How then did you incorporate that into the tall fescue bluegrass selection process? Was that sort of already decided by the time you got there and you were just perpetuating it? And how much time did you spend thinking about the varieties and stuff like that for us grass geeks? You and I ought to talk a little bit about grass today on our conversation. So how much did the flooring and the way it was going to be used impact your decision on the grass types?
You know, that did not play as much of a role in the decking as far as the grass types. And I was able to, for this second phase, the phase that I was here for, you know, I was able to geek out and spend some time. We got some input from Kevin Morris from NTEP, the National Turf Grass Evaluation Program. And then you're kind of, you might look at the end taps and go, okay, this is the mix I want. And then you go and shop it around and realize, well, that seed's not available and that seed's not available.
That's exactly right. You can't find half the seed that's
So it just ends up being like this back and forth about like what seed you can get and what's on the end taps. So that's really what we were looking for. We're looking for some stuff that did have some traffic resistance was the biggest thing, obviously, because that's what our deal is. We were also looking for some winter color and an early spring green up. And some disease resistance.
And the tall fescue would be good for that, right?
Yeah,
tall fescue.
Yes, it would
good
be.
For that. I guess the question that I have, and this probably will be my last grass question before we start to wrap it up, but one of the knocks on tall fescue, particularly as you get further north, Michael, is that it gets clump type, it gets bunchy, especially as it gets worn out. Your management moving forward, you said, and I think we were talking offline and you mentioned, you know, one of the things you got to get over is, you know, you can't just grow grass. Sometimes you're in the grass replacement business as well. So how much grass is having to be replaced? And if not, tall fescue, if it thins in any way from what you do to it, is going to need some regular overseeding. Are you doing either regular turf replacement and overseeding as a part of your sort of sustaining the cover there?
So you're right. I mean, if as you start to get traffic and you start to get things worn away, if it's not robust, that tall fescue tends to get thick bladed, you know, and bunchy. It really does. So that is something that we're starting to see, and I wonder. And granted, we saw this on 4-year old grass panels that we did, you know, started in 2012, and so you know there might be the idea. So a couple things. Like one is that there was a bluegrass in that mix that was, you know, from the 60s. It's, you know, and I don't know why you would use 60s technology, but it was available. And that bluegrass basically just, you know, went away. As soon as you put traffic on it, it just went away. So we had been overseeding with tall fescue from the get-go. And I find tall fescue to actually be pretty aggressive, in an overseeding situation. I mean, it's not quite ryegrass, but I don't feel like it's that far off as far as the robustness of the seedlings.
I agree 100%. I think people sometimes don't think about that, that it isn't that far behind with perennial ryegrass as an overseeder. So you are overseeding as a part of what you're doing.
Yeah, we do. And the funny thing is I was actually just sitting down and doing the work plan for this year. And this is the first time we've actually had the whole entire mall on them. I'm trying to do some of the research that was done at Cornell, about the rates being, overseeding overseeding.
Oh, the heavy overseeding rates that we did years ago, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, and then there's definitely, huge difference from that, that we see. And plus I have all the traffic that allows it to get, just gets beaten in. And we also aerate twice a month because of the traffic. So that also, all that works well together.
Wait, we got to stop here. This is every golf superintendent just practically fell off of their chair. Did you say you aerify that place twice a month?
Yes.
So great.
So this also goes down a rabbit hole where the first phase is, neither Norm Hummel did the testing, but he wasn't involved with developing the specification, and I wasn't here yet. Ended up some really heavy soils on those first three panels. So I'm curious to see what my aeration process will be like on these panels, these mostly sand panels that are the majority of them. I still have budgeted to, aerate twice a month because I'm still trying to get, sod to knit in and get rid of the sod layer. So I don't mind that, but it's going to be, I'm hoping that I would be able to back off on that as we go.
One last thing, Michael, about grass before we wrap it up for today is a replacement. When is that decision made? Have you had to do much in some of the new panels? And I guess the biggest thing I always struggle with when I've had to be involved in making decisions of replacing some turf in stadiums and things, you always wish you took two more feet. no matter where you put the line, after you put that new sod down, you look at the interface. why didn't we just put one more piece down, right? So do you find yourself in those dilemmas very often?
I realize is it's all perspective. It's like, yeah, it doesn't look so bad when you're like compared to the turf that you're replacing. And then all of a sudden you get good turf down and go, oh, man, I should have gone 2 more feet.
That's exactly right. So that's a big challenge with getting into the replacement mindset. But was that a tough mindset for you to get into replacement, right? We train turf managers to grow grass. And I think I would say I grew up in an area where if you had to resod a lot, it must have been you didn't know how to grow grass.
It always seemed like cheating to me when you resodded a lot.
Right. So you're of the same ilk that I think a lot of people are in this business that thinks, hey, I get paid to grow grass. But how have you worked that out in your head that, you know, sometimes surrender is the better part of valor?
You know, that's a funny thing. I mean, I know, a lot of successful golf course superintendents who do a lot of sodding. And, you know, they're very successful. Their places are mint. It's just like, to me, I'm trying to get out of my own head would be, what you exactly said, but also like, hey, if the grass isn't growing there must be a reason. We should figure out what that reason is and then fix that before we go and replace the sod. And that kind of, when you get in your head, that's always, a bad sign because it's kind of paralyzing. So when I got here, all of a sudden you just start to realize that, it's one of those things that you need to do. I mean, it's just, and believe me, sodding at, 2-inch sod, and sometimes you can use thick cut sod if you want, is, a much easier prospect than, bent grass areas and fairways and collars and that sort of thing. So
the whole system's a little more resilient.
Yeah.
And that's why, putting that sod in and moving it in and around isn't that challenging.
Yeah. I just had to kind of get used to that. The saying that there's a couple of things that I heard that made me think, and I can't remember. And I think it was Nicole McFadden from Baltimore Orioles. She had mentioned that her field was getting old, and it was time to look at redoing it. And I was like, huh, just the sod, replacing the sod. I'm going, huh. Wait a minute. I'm looking at these panels that have been kind of worn back, and we got some clumpy tall fescue, and we got grass everywhere, and it's green, but it didn't quite have the uniformity that we want. It's like it might be time to do either a full scale sodding or the scarifying that removes the
phrase mowing.
Thank you.
And I got to tell you, I think that. Part of why I believe what we're talking about is important is I think some of the practices that we can now implement to renovate allow for less disruption and are more commonplace. They're not sort of out of left field anymore because such a large part of our industry around the world, I'll tell you, Michael, is regularly embracing a significant resurfacing as part of their normal maintenance. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here, isn't it? It's become a primary practice to occasionally say that surface has outlived its useful life. Let's sort of phrase it off and rejuvenate.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at with that thinking. Like, if I could put in phrase mowing for 1 or 2 panels a year, and I can close them down without because there's plenty of other space, and I can close them down to fully get them in. I would rather do that than sod. And I'd like to think that I could grow grass as well as a sod farmer if I've got the time and be able to close it down. So that certainly is something. And it's funny, I guess they're once again being in your head, but people are really the new sod that's been down. People love it. They think it's the greatest. They think you're the greatest for overseeing that project.
It's a wow factor. But it's a wow.
But you're like, well, I really haven't done anything yet. So I just, I just made sure the trucks could come in and got them, get laid. That's it.
Well, listen, we even got to talk about some grass, Michael, and when I originally approached you about this, you were very clear that, that isn't, as an agronomist, you're actually, sort of almost apologetic to the point where, I'm not actually out there sort of getting my hands dirty the way I used to do it, but I will tell you What a great advocate at our national mall and in the nation's capital. We couldn't really have a better guy there. And I know, you know, Jeff Reinhart and Kevin Mars so well. You guys have a pretty good turf setup going there. It's really been an honor for me to take this time to chat with you, Michael. I really appreciate you taking the time and keep up the great work.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
This is probably one podcast I won't listen to.
That's right. Me too, Michael. Michael Stackowitz, the turf specialist for the National Park Service at the National Mall Memorial Parks. I'm Frank Rossi. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers.